is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. Welcome again to Sasheen. Can you hear me okay? Yeah? Okay, cool. Good. You gotta try to remember to check that on Zoom too if you're ever speaking to a group, because you have no idea. You can hear yourself. Not only do we have the usual thing with our minds, but then also through the technology. So, Sasheen. That would be good to remember what that word means. It's a Sino-Japanese word, which is a compound of two characters. The Japanese, when they're thinking about the Chinese, pronounce as the first character as Setsu, and the second character as Shin. So Setsu, the first character, I always knew to mean to connect or to touch. When I first met this word, somebody told me it was to gather, but I don't see that in any of the dictionaries. So to connect or to touch something. And the something seems to be the second, referred to by the second character, Shin, the wonderful word that means both heart and mind in the East Asian languages. Different cultures have different ways of saying it, but the whole bunch of cultures all adopted the same characters from China. So there's a character that means heart and mind together. So connecting with the heart mind, touching the heart mind. But then just for fun, this morning I looked up Setsu again in a different dictionary, the one that Bob Rose has been using. That gives more variations of meaning in the old readings as he's gone through Shirto's poem. He's done this with his friend. And I found out that Setsu also means to receive. So that's really helpful for those of us who tend to push to do something, you know, do something right. You gotta work hard probably to connect with something or touch something or gather something. But to receive something is a whole different matter, right? Different orientation, different attitude to receive something. So what are we touching or receiving? You know, what is this heart mind? And I don't know, maybe we each develop our own kind of sense of that. Seems to me, as of this morning anyway, that some other words, it's all only words, right? But some other words that point in the same direction might include Buddha nature, maybe the soul, our true self. Sometimes the phrase a mind ground is used, which I love. You know, something so grounded about that. The mind ground, the heart mind is like the grounded mind. And mind here always means something bigger than a bunch of thoughts. Right, thoughts are just one aspect of mind. It's a big version of mind. But since Bob's been going on a bit about Chinese characters, I'm feeling some permission to look at the actual characters with you. So I'm going to do that. Using the wonders of technology. And the thing that I think is interesting, let me shrink this down a little bit so we can do one at a time there. This is the character Setsu in one of the calligraphic styles. And like most Chinese characters, it's pretty dense and blocky, and there's a lot going on. And one wonders how the human mind could interpret thousands of these and read them, you know. It kind of feels very deep, you know. this turning towards or receiving or gathering. And who knows where all that came from. But the thing that I want to point out that's fascinating to me is the character for Sheen is not like that. When I first met this, I thought, is that even a Chinese character? That just looks like this sort of fluid little squiggle. It's open, it's curvy, and this is like a fairly blocky version of it. And I always kind of imagine this kind of hook on the, this kind of long stroke on the bottom, which is the second stroke. I kind of imagine you can kind of slide down that, you know, like a slide. And when you get more cursive, it gets really wild, you know, fluid, very open character. So I don't know if that helps your practice, but I find it pretty interesting that there's these so many layers of meaning and language that we receive this through. And if we were Asian Buddhists, we would have those images in our minds, and who knows how that affects everything. We certainly are deeply affected by language, right? The words that we know are the words we use to describe our reality and ourselves, and that kind of creates our reality and ourselves in a very powerful way. And as we practice, we of course start to feel into the reality that there's more to reality than what we can talk about with words. So anyway, I just think it's interesting, this character, this idea, heart, mind, fluid, swoopy, open, curvy, you know, not so blocky and dense. And if you look at where the rubber meets the road on the schedule, it seems like our ancestors feel strongly that the way to do this, or whatever the doing is that's involved in touching the heart mind or receiving the heart mind, that Zazen seems to definitely be important since we give a lot of time to it. This upright, open, stable way of kind of like being at home in the body, in the moment, in the mind. And even if the body or the mind or the whatever is not at the moment to our liking, this powerful structure that supports engagement with it, right? Being with it anyway, right? We don't, in the Zazen instructions, we don't say, well, sit down, you know, settle your body and breath and breathe. And if you feel peaceful, enjoy that for 30 minutes. If you don't like it, then yeah, get up and do something else because it's obviously not working for you. Right, which is kind of our usual approach. So we have this structure that encourages us to be at home in the heart, mind, and in the body, regardless, right? Regardless of whether it's currently to our liking or not. So there's something kind of powerful about that, you know, right? A commitment to being with our heart, mind, body. And maybe being at home in it is not too strong a statement. So I was thinking about Shuso Bob's choice to study the Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage so thoroughly with us, and how that's a poem about home, right? It's really a poem about home. Being at home in the grass shack, even though it's going to fall apart, even though weeds will grow, being at home in the skin bag, not separating from the body in the grass shack, whether it's a brand new, shiny, green, fresh-smelling grass shack or an old, falling apart one, you know, and the same with the body, being at home there, and all those interesting practice points about how to be at home there. And then I'm thinking, like, wow, it's extra interesting that we're studying this being at home in the heart, mind, and in the grass shack, in this strange period, you know, that none of us could ever have imagined, where the Sangha is homeless, and we're doing it all through this medium. And yet each of us is in our, some kind of home, you know, whether it's a home we've lived in for decades, or a boat, or a borrowed apartment, or somewhere else. We're all in some way at home together through this. And sitting Zazen, practicing being at home in the body and the mind. And Shirto's suggesting we will find some ease here. That's a big theme of the poem and the practice. At times it may be hard to really believe that after eating we're going to relax and enjoy a nap. We were talking last night about appropriate practices, and we talked about work practice during the afternoon when we're not on Zoom. And so that seems to be deeply endorsed by the tradition. After lunch, relax, enjoy, live here calmly. And just like Zazen includes sitting when it's not that pleasant, that also includes an afternoon when we're too awake to take a nap, right? Taking a nap can include not being able to take a nap. It's all a journey. And the poem really is that true, you know, that it's a process, maybe a long process, finding out through practice and experience how not to get stuck, right? He talks about that. Not to get stuck in some idea, not to get stuck in wanting it to be somewhere else, not being stuck inside, outside, or in between anything. So there's a fluidity and a flexibility over time. And to live in the world and be okay with the world that we have, you know, that our 10 by 10 foot room also includes bizarre politics of the day and all of our limitations and problems and doubts and fears, right? It's all of it. It's all of it. And that it's all changing too. You know? He talks about that. We practice here whether the hut will perish or not perish, whether it's impermanent or not, as we seek our home. And yet the other interesting thing about our tradition is it makes a big deal about leaving home. That the monk's ordination, the priest's ordination, is called the home-leaving ceremony. So do we leave the home we thought we had to seek a new home, or to find home? And most Buddhist monastics and Catholic monastics and other traditions do literally leave home when they ordain. They give up their family name and take on an ordination name, become, you know, Stone Top Mountain, or become Sister Teresa, not the name they were born with. And most monastics also give up possessions, right? Live through a rule of poverty, celibacy, and obedience. And through a weird quirk of history, our particular tradition doesn't do that so literally. And maybe we have a harder job because we leave home while staying at home in our tradition, continuing our work within the world, you know, the world that we were in before we ordained. But it's not exactly the same world after we ordain, and whether ordaining looks like formal stuff with shaving heads or being more quiet, that's your own internal choice. Home, to find home. So I was thinking about this also, that it's 20 years for me since I did this ceremony of home leaving. And at the time, I didn't physically leave at all. I was very much involved in deeply investigating being home. At the time, I'd been married for about 9 years to my high school sweetheart. And so many months of that next my wife, our first child, turned out to be our only child, and we did the practice of raising a child together, which is a crazy deep practice. So my leaving was very much not home leaving 20 years ago. So there's so many ways this goes, this journey of finding home and leaving home. A little sidebar there, just about the tradition, is in Japan it's a little different again, because many ordained Zen priests do live in temples, Because they got like hundreds of temples there. We don't have temples, you know. We have a temple shortage. And then it's interesting. It's not exactly like other traditions because the Japanese temple priests usually live there with their families. So the temple is their home and a private space all together. Although maybe that's not that different for us anyway. Are you allowing your home to become a temple, practicing in that way? And one wonderful example is several of us have had the opportunity to go to Japan and spend some time at Rinzai Temple in Yaizu, Japan, which is the temple that Shunryu Suzuki, who we call Suzuki Roshi usually around here, left, a temple he left in 1959 to come to San Francisco, which is important causal act for us, you know, because we're in that lineage, so we wouldn't be here doing this. We would never have thought of this, right? No way. And yet that temple that he left remained the home, the temple home of his family that he left behind. Left behind. A little bit like Buddha, you know. And that's a challenging part of our tradition too. Sometimes our religious leaders in our tradition are somehow inspired to like leave their family behind. And Shunryu Suzuki, you know, Suzuki Roshi, his son, now in his 80s, talks very honestly about his dad and says he wasn't a very good dad. You know? He wasn't there for me. He left for America, left me behind with relatives, you know. And yet, what a wonderful gift to us, you know. So nothing's simple, is it? And nothing comes without some pain for somebody. Anyway, now it's quite beautiful if you get to go there, and I hope more of us will get to go there if they're still willing to receive us guys, you know. That Huitzu Suzuki, Suzuki Roshi's son, lives there in his 80s, and his son, Suzuki Roshi's grandson, Shungo Suzuki, lives there with both with their wives and Shungo with his kids. And so it's their home, but members of the Sangha show up all kinds of times, you know, sometimes scheduled, sometimes not, to visit the temple and to make offerings and to seek advice from the priest and to do a ceremony, often a memorial ceremony. You go up to the temple or they come to you on anniversaries of important deaths to do a memorial ceremony every year. So that's pretty interesting. Tradition of being at home in a homeless place, you know, in a temple, in a public place. And we can think about that if we ever get a building. Would some of us want to live there and have that experience? Would that work in our context? Anyway, in my case, I stayed home, tried to practice there. Learned a lot and grew and changed in many ways. Woke up in some ways and fell asleep in other ways. And strangely, during this time of homelessness for the Sangha, 20 years after my ordination, I finally did leave home. And I won't share the whole convoluted story about all that. Of course, too personal and everything, but somehow, more shifts happened in my life, and shifts happen to us all kinds of times, right? And changes happen that we don't expect. And somehow I realized a big change was needed, even though that did cause some pain for others and for myself. And, you know, confusing situation for me and for my ex-wife, Janet. There wasn't exactly something terribly wrong. We weren't fighting or miserable or anything, but somehow I realized through all kinds of weird ways that it wasn't right anymore. It wasn't home. We weren't home together anymore. And we have conventional ways of talking about that, like we were now living separate lives or we drifted apart, but that doesn't seem quite complete Even though it's easy to say that, I don't really understand what happened. But last January, I left that home to live in my own home, alone for the first time in my whole life, actually. Always lived with other people. And made a grass shack to live in and practice in. So strange how it goes, right? These journeys we all live through. Never what we expect. And amazing how persistent the mind is, at least mine is, in trying to imagine what's going to happen and predict. And then so confusing and maybe a little upsetting when what we plan doesn't happen. Which is very strange, right? Because it never does. We're very resistant to evidence in that way. And so now living a little different journey, but the same journey, just different. And when you change, when your home changes or your sense of being at home changes, do you right away find yourself in a new home? Are you homeless? Does it inspire you to look differently at your life and your home? And many of us have had the good fortune, I think it's mostly good fortune, to live under a particular roof, you know, so a physical home with some stability for years. So is that what home is? Is it where you sleep? What are the dimensions of home? And so here I am giving this talk from Hannah's Bellingham home. She's in the Rockport home that her husband Jerry built with his own hands. And lots of help, I'm sure. So many homes. And one of the things I really get to enjoy is sometimes when I visit homes of Sangha members, it's like really a fun little thing for me, is I sometimes see the little annual calligraphy cards that we send on mantelpieces or shelves. Actually, there's one right behind my head there. See it kind of poking out. The Siddham character for wisdom that I made years ago. Anyway, Hannah has a few of those. And one of them is the one that we sent to mark the end of 2016. I'm sorry, I don't have it in my within reach. And on there I put the phrase, a Zen phrase, Musojo, Musojo, which means no resting place, no resting place, which makes me think of the Prajnaparamita teachings about where did bodhisattvas stand, you know, where do they rest? And the answer, according to the Prajnaparamita teachings, is they rest in having nowhere to stand. So that's kind of true too. There ultimately is no home. Everything. No resting place. What a strange tradition we have, huh? We take comfort in that teaching that there's no resting place. We can practice resting into that. And for this last month, I've gotten to practice and be at home with Raisala in her home in Northern California, we first met at a Zen temple, Green Gulch Farm Zen Center, decades ago in our 20s. So many surprises happen and changes. And it's wonderful when our home changes, but it's also hard, right? It's also disorienting. It's also strange. And also deeply comforting and beautiful. And I'm thinking maybe that's the practice of finding home, is it needs both of those elements. A deep sense of arrival, comfort, safety. But also I think it's good if we notice, you know, if we really notice there's something, a little something here, you know, whatever we want to call that with language. I've been calling it being a little disoriented, maybe. That's not quite the right word, though. An aliveness, a surprisingness of reality. that when we lose track of that quality, the unknowableness, the hmm-ness, really, wow, in our resting at home, then we fall asleep at home, and then we're not really home anymore. We're just in a place that looks like home. For me, it's better not to lean too hard into ease, even as we seek ease. Here's a little snippet of Rumi that speaks to that a little, maybe. The breeze at dawn has secrets to tell you. Don't go back to sleep. You must ask for what you really want. Don't go back to sleep. People are going back and forth across the door sill where the two worlds touch. The door is round and open. Don't go back to sleep. The breeze at dawn has secrets to tell you. Don't go back to sleep. You must ask for what you really want. Don't go back to sleep. People are going back and forth across the door sill where two worlds touch. The door is round and open. Don't go back to sleep. Maybe that's our practice, is to be deeply at home, but deeply awake. Curious, present. And so Sheen is such a great support for that, isn't it? Not always so easy. At every moment of Sheen, we have so much structure and support around our awakeness and our settling into home. Home in this breath. Home in this moment, feeling the peacefulness and the whatever the other thing is, the curiosity, the wonder, that maybe instead of disorienting, I should say reorienting. Sounds more positive, doesn't it? Maybe in every moment there's a kind of reorienting that's happening as we remember at some level, this is not the same as the last moment. Don't go back to sleep. And it's such a long journey, isn't it? And that's such a blessing of Sangha life, is that we get to be there for each other on these long journeys. It's been inspiring and sometimes sad and sometimes confusing, sometimes amazing, for me anyway, to watch myself, as little as I can tell what I'm doing, but also it's easier, I think, to watch in other people, to watch their journeys. So we all seek home. Because it's 20 years since the ordination last year, but it's also 30 years since the Sangha was founded this year. It's a big anniversary year. In those 30 years, I know this now. I don't know if I knew it at the time, but those 30 years, I feel really blessed, actually, to got to watch people and be with people in the Sangha and other parts of my life, you know. Watching us work through challenges, so many challenges, right? Physical challenges, health challenges, emotional challenges, relationship challenges. The way we can get so deeply caught by our wounds, our losses, our sense of inadequacy, and the way we can arise out of that, you know, gloriously, beautifully. Thinking of some moments of watching somebody after a sesshin or after maybe they've been in the middle of a big ceremony, like a shuso ceremony, and watching that, there's a certain kind of smile that's only available then. You know, you can see it, you go, wow. And this healing takes such a long time, and maybe it's really good that we have this sort of Buddhist framework, whether we believe it literally or not, of multiple lifetimes being required here. Because we've also, over the years, and this is the hard part, seen people, at least from my point of view, be so caught, you know, so deeply caught by these layers of suffering and pain, where it kind of drowns them, right? And they leave practice in some way. Maybe they come back again, maybe they leave again, as they try to get in and out of this door, round and open. Or maybe they perceive that door is shut tight and not available to them. So it's a challenging thing, this thing. It's not a simple little thing of just calming down, is it? You know, I want to find some peace. I'll take up Zen practice. Zen practice is life, right? So I want to find a little peace. I'll take up being alive. Whoops, it's a lot more complicated, it turns out. A lot more difficult and a lot more wonderful than I could have imagined. So Bob has been very busy digging up, Bob Rose, digging up these treasures. You know, he's got like this shovel and he's digging up all these Dharma treasures as we go through the poem. So I just want to bring our attention back to one of my favorites. As he's investigated Master Shurto and everything connected to his amazing poem about grass shacks. Here's one of those cases he came upon. A monk named Huilong asked Master Shurto, "What is the awakened one?" The master said, "You don't have awakened mind." Huilong, the student, dejected, said, "I'm just human. I know I run around and have all kinds of ideas." The master said, "Active people with ideas still have awakened mind." Huilong said, "Then why don't I?" The master said, "Because you are not satisfied to be just human." Huilong had deep realization. A nice description of this journey. So a monk asked the teacher, "What is the awakened one?" and all the things that stands for. The master said, "You don't have awakened mind." The student, bummed out, you know, maybe he's already been practicing for a long time, you know, I'm just human, I know. I run around, I have all these ideas, I'm really mixed up. Teacher said, "Well, it's okay. Active people with ideas still have the awakened mind." Huilong said, "Then why don't I? Why don't I?" Master, "Because you're not satisfied to just be human. You're not satisfied to be just human." That helped, right? That was the nudge. That was the encouragement to step through that door, round and open, to realize that it's okay. Bigger than okay, to realize that you're already home. And one of the strange things about practice is we don't always necessarily feel particularly different, you know. Our evaluative mind that's trying to figure out how we feel is still our evaluative mind that's trying to figure out how we feel. We start to notice that we're responding and engaging in the world differently over time. Like the other day, I found out a friend was in trouble. And it's a friend that I have a long, complicated history with, like so many friends. I often feel like kind of confused or resistant or how can I help or, you know, all kinds of narratives going on in my mind, but I called the person up anyway. Got through a little resistance right away. Called the person up, and somehow it was just beautiful. Somehow it was just being home together, even in the person's pain, and even with the pain in me that it activated. We could just be at home together and support each other. And in the relative world, it looked like I was giving the other person support and advice, and the other person felt like, "Oh, I'm suffering and I'm confused," but I could feel, no, we're just here together, just two people trying to practice this, just be human. And it doesn't solve anything in that way of problems and solutions, but it also solves everything. The problems aren't problems in the same way anymore when we deeply accept our humanity. And feel into how wondrous and limited it all is, you know. Infinite and so constricted at the same time. conditioned and beyond conditioning. Alive and dying, every one of us dying out. And we're receiving that practice now from in our Sangha. We've been doing this long enough. Now people are starting to die, just like people do. You know, it's another thing that people do. And so we can also be in the grass shack with each other as we pass away from this life, staying awake and staying present. And being close to the heart mind. I had some other stuff I was thinking of saying, but now it doesn't feel relevant anymore. That was the me of a few hours ago. Everything always changing. Let's just sit a minute and then I'll formally close the talk, but whatever, sit with whatever is currently up for you, whether it's connected to something I was saying or not. But maybe the most important thing I was trying to say is just to remember what we're doing together right now. Sei Shin, Setsu Shin, touching and receiving the heart mind. And this wonderful teaching of Shirto, this poem, but also this case. To be satisfied, to be just fully human. Let's just breathe with that for a minute. Thanks so much for everything. Let's do the closing chant. There's also an intention setting chant, right? May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become.